AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Dow Automotive Systems, improving durability and increasing design flexibility with Betamate structural adhesives at DowBetamate.com.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 41 for Thursday, February 4, 2010. Racing rocks. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern or 2400 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free. Try searching for AutoLine After Hours at the iTunes Store.
Well, here we are Thursday night once again, AutoLine After Hours, and joining me once again, as always, the auto extremist himself, Peter DeLorenzo. Peter.
John, great to be here.
It's great to be here with you.
And still alive.
Still alive. That's always good to be. Hey, you had a great rant going in your on your website this week. I burst out laughing several times, and that's always, you know, to me, the sign of great writing and making
you.
Points that I agree with, by the way.
Thank you.
And one of the things we got to get into later in the show, because we got some other introductions to get here right away, but are we hitting a tipping point?
For Toyota,
maybe the Japanese in total. Is it a tipping point the other way for the Detroit 3? I think it's a great issue, something that we got to get into. But also got to welcome David Welch here from Business Week. Bloomberg Business Week, or is it?
Always great to be here, John. Many thanks.
So, what's big and new in your life since we last saw you a week ago?
All Toyota all the time.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, I've got a story on Toyota in the mag this week. You know, it is all Toyota all the time. I've pitched in a bit on the Bloomberg coverage as well. You know, it's one of these stories that's tough to write because I'm closing a magazine story on a Wednesday, and more stuff just keeps happening with Toyota, and we'll talk about it in the show, but it's like literally like every half hour something else comes on the Bloomberg
screen. It's unreal. You know, yeah, I thought
and one of the cool things about working at Bloomberg is you put auto news and you're getting, I mean, like even Al Jazeera, is picking up stuff on the Prius. You know? So you're seeing everything from around the globe being reported on Toyota, and it's just nonstop.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of global interests, you know, because we know this from a year ago. In fact, I was interviewed by Al Jazeera myself several times on the whole meltdown in Detroit. So, you know, now the news cycle is the meltdown at Toyota. So it doesn't surprise me at all that they're on it. But, yeah, everyone's on this story. Yeah. And then joining us is our special guest tonight. We've got Jamie Allison, the head of all Ford Racing here. Jamie, great having you.
Oh, it's a delight to be here. I'm very excited, so thank you for inviting me.
So what's the official title? I called you the head of Ford Racing, but what's your business card say?
Officially, I'm the director of North America Motorsports at
okay.
Ford.
And is there a global Ford Motorsports, or how does that fit in with Ford's racing activities elsewhere
in
the world?
Ford is a global company, as we all know, and Ford wants to be even more globally unified. And I speak with and regularly interface with the head of Ford of Europe Motorsports and Ford of South America and Asia. So they're not as large of an operation because they support different forms of racing, and they're not as deep into the business that we're in. But nonetheless, there are local representations.
Now, don't let Alan Mulally hear that, because he talks one Ford, and
that doesn't sound
like one Ford to me.
Well, one Ford is making its way across all parts of the company, and we are one Ford Motorsports.
So what all racing are you involved with Ford North American Racing?
You name it. If it's on four wheels and has a Ford oval on it, we touch it. From professional racing, NASCAR and NHRA, and the addition of Rally and Rally America. That's one form, and then serving enthusiasts who like to modify their cars to our performance parts business, to people who love to just go into pro-am racing, and then we offer race cars, something that we, along with
Ford. Yeah, tell us about that. Yeah. This I did not know. Yeah. You can actually go to a Ford dealer.
Yep.
And buy a Ford racing car.
Absolutely.
Like what models do you have?
We offer two, soon to be three models. First of all, you can only get the car by the way, it's not a car, it's a race part, to be legally correct, from the parts counter at your local Ford dealership.
And these are not street legal.
These are not street legal.
This is track ready, though.
Track ready, with a roll cage, ready, in some cases, homologated for a series or a class. So we have the Boss 302R, which runs in Can-Am at the GS series. We have the Cobra Jets, which are in sportsman class racing.
And drag racing.
Drag racing. And then we announced that we're going to offer a Raptor XT, which is an extra terrain, off-road capable, kind of a pre-runner setup for from the Raptor. So
is that for score for the off-road racing?
We haven't quite picked in which series it will run in. Likely in the U.S. it'll be best in the desert, but eventually someone can run it in score in the Baja, which we did with the production.
This is your rally car, basically.
The Raptor is a truck.
Oh, it's a truck.
Yeah,
okay.
It's a truck. The Raptor's a truck, yeah. And we haven't quite made
that's
our way.
Right. It's the
F-Series.
Right.
That monster, right, yeah.
Okay. And then we're working with our European counterparts on, obviously, when Fiesta and Focus are here, to offer rally-prepared versions of those cars. So, yes.
So, let's say I go to the Ford dealer. Mm-hmm. What's it going to cost me to get a Mustang race car?
The Mustang, the Boss 302R, comes in two spec, Can-Am homologation at $129,000. Which is a bargain compared to what you can buy the Camaro or the BMW setup. And then the kind of a your own club racer in the garage, go in SCCA or NASA.
What's a Camaro or BMW race car?
The Camaro number I remember is like 159, 169, and the BMW M3 prepared for a Can-Am is in the 2+, 225 plus. Mm-hmm. So 129, a bargain, given that we won the championship in Can-Am 3 out of the last 5 years in that car.
So you put a business case together to sell race cars. How many have you sold? How do you go about doing this?
Obviously, we reach out, and we are in the series. We talk and listen to competitors, and we understand what they're looking for. And we get a gauge for how many we can sell. But more importantly, we go out with a pre-order. We send out a notice that says, if you're interested in this car, please place an order. We'll close the window in about 90 days, and whatever we have is what we'll build. So they're all pre-sold. The Cobra Jets is our kind of, our barometers, because every time we open the order bank, we get 50, 60, 70 orders within a couple weeks, and we cap them at 50, just to kind of keep the excitement and the stimulation.
And the Cobra Jet program was interesting because your colleague Brian Wolf,
yeah,
who was a drag racer, but he, I don't recall the last time that an American manufacturer built something like that for drag racing. It had been a long time, right?
Yeah, I mean, Brian is the father of the Cobra Jet, and he himself drag raced, and he came through the 50 or the Pro 50 ranks, and building a car that's directed at sportsman class, and I don't think anybody else does. I mean, ready to race versus what Dodge did with the Challenger, where you actually you buy a stock car and then you buy a kit and then you put it together and then you go out running. And
no, but ready to race.
Ready to race, you pick it up from the dealership and off you go.
When's the last time Ford did that? Was the Thunderbolt program in the 60s?
Yeah, that's the days.
Remember the Thunderbolt?
No, I don't remember the Thunderbolt.
Oh, man.
These were drag racers?
Badass Fairlane with the 427 motor, and it just awesome lightweight panels. It had four headlights, but the inside headlights were for Ram Air,
yep,
as I recall. I mean, it was cool.
So you're making a profit off doing this. You're treating this as a business. You're not just doing it to polish the brand or something like that.
Well, there's always that element.
Sure there is, but this
Ford
is a business.
This isn't a loss leader, in other words.
No. This is pretty generous profit in the something the parent company would be very envious of. We generate a pretty healthy profit in the 20-30% range, gross profit margin.
And then what, you take that profit and pour it into the racing program, or?
We pour it in investment in other products that generate more profit.
Okay, so does the racing program make money? Not including the parts, just the pure race?
Well, there's professional racing like NASCAR and NHRA and Rally, and that's done for marketing purposes.
Okay.
Where we go out, we work with teams, we sponsor programs, and that's marketing, right? We go out and these are marketing programs. And there's everything else, right? If you buy a performance pack for your car, if you buy a race car, If you buy a crate engine for your street rod, that's the realm by which we look at.
That's where the money's made.
That's where the money's made.
Because the other racing's all one-way money.
Is it worth it? I mean, NASCAR doesn't seem to be at the peak of frenzy it was in this country, say, 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Television's down, ratings, that is. Attendance is definitely down.
Yep.
Is it still worth being in?
Yeah, I mean, everything we do is very measured and with data and with facts, even, you know, and everything we touch. So, we conduct research regularly to measure the effectiveness of anything we touch.
How do you measure it?
We go out with research, and here's the research that comes back on NASCAR, is that 40% of all new car intenders, if you raise your hand and say, I'm going to buy a new car, we sample. 40% of all new car intenders consider themselves a motorsports fan. They say, yes, I love motorsports. So they're buying a car, going to buy a car, and they say...
That sounds like an astonishingly high number.
Exactly. I mean, which says, and then we then ask them, what forms of motorsport do you follow? NASCAR, 80%. Because it's a part of the American fiber. It's, you know, it has evolved from its roots, but nonetheless, today... Indeed, you know, a population still follows. And then
so NHRA. 32% of new car buyers are NASCAR fans.
You translate the 40% times the 80%. So
that seems really high to me. I mean, I know it's a popular sport, but wow.
However, as I reported, NASCAR is on the verge of some big changes.
Like what?
Well, as Jamie will attest, and people at General Motors and Chrysler will say, it's become more urgent for the manufacturers. The word relevant has become more important to the manufacturers, and NASCAR really isn't all that relevant when you're running carburetors and when the average street car has more technology in it than your average NASCAR stock car in terms of electronics. And so there's a push right now, which NASCAR is embracing, to do something about it, to bring... production specs back into the sport somehow, and you know Jamie might be able to expand, but the conversation's ongoing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first thing I did when I was appointed, which is just a few weeks ago, traveled down to Charlotte and visited with Mike Helton and the team at NASCAR, and I had happened to be in Ford Racing for the past 6 years, just on the other side, and. You know, we listen, we understand, we are in touch with all the enthusiasts, all the fans who just want to just be a part of the Ford Oval. And then I echoed, I shared with Mike, and then he concurs in the fact that there, you know, from our perspective, there's really three areas that we pay attention to. One is people like to see more connection between the cars that races and the car they drive.
In other words, the car of tomorrow has been pretty much a disaster.
Yeah. I wouldn't say those words, but
that's why I'm here. Yeah,
that's exactly right. Like that.
Thank you. But yeah, I mean, people like to see that connection, the roots of it, NASCAR and all other roots of racing kind of evolved from that. And then two, the connection between the technology, right? The cars you're in and the powertrain that you drive, whether it's, you know, progression of eco-friendly, whether it's hybrid. All that plays in the mix of fans who are watching the sport. And then third is, you know, the sport evolved into a place where basically the focus is on the driver, which is great. But as a manufacturer, we want to make sure that there's actually some return to the company. So these are all fairly straightforward, and we're all in agreement that these are areas we want to work on.
How about rallying, though?
Oh,
isn't that that's the hot thing now.
Yeah, how long have you guys been in rallying?
Well, Ford has been in rally since, you know, probably Peter can help me with history there.
But Europe, they've been running for...
I mean, in the U.S.
Very recently.
Yeah.
Well, rallying in the U.S. is, you know, it's a perpetually, everyone wants it to succeed more than it has.
Yeah.
In Europe, rallying is a huge deal. Huge budget.
Oh, yeah. I think rally racing is the coolest motorsport to watch. I love watching it more than any of the others.
Ford's been very successful.
Yeah. But getting it on TV and really watching a lot of races is pretty tough to do. And you know, there's just it's not all that accessible, probably, because you know, it sort of has this chicken and egg thing, it seems.
Well, in Europe, you know, it's common for spectators to go out in the wilderness and you know, camp and drink and watch a car go by.
I mean, Americans hate camping and drinking.
Yeah. Americans like to sit.
But rallying hasn't managed to make the connection here. I guess if we sold rallying as, like, you go camping and you drink. Oh, really?
Yeah,
I'm in.
Right.
And cars go by once in a while? Yeah, oh, great.
I like that. That's actually the pitch, because that's what they like about, you know,
that's right.
But I think in terms of rallying in this country, you know, Ford has just signed
Ken Block,
mm-hmm. who's a legendary YouTube sensation, formerly driving on other brands.
Yeah, yeah.
But Ford has just signed him. And that's a huge deal. And that lit up the internet big time, because Ken Block has done some fabulous videos.
Have you ever seen some of his stuff?
Which car are you racing, by the way?
The Fiesta.
Fiesta, okay.
Ford is formerly, the sport has evolved whereby, obviously, the smaller the car, the better mm-hmm. the power-to-weight ratio. So WRC, World Rally, is moving to B-size cars, which is our Fiesta. So Ford.
They were in C cars before.
Today they're running C cars, yeah. And we're switching in 2011 WRC, and we got a head start here in the U.S. and Rally America. So Fiesta made its debut here in Michigan. Yeah, yeah.
In fact, Kevin Kennedy sent me a link here for me to watch. Was it Block that was driving in that?
Block driving. You have it?
Oh, my. Yes, I do. I don't know if we can get that up. It's coming?
Oh, okay. We got to see that.
Here we go.
We got to see this. This is up here in Michigan.
Yeah.
In Atlanta, Michigan.
Yeah.
Which is near Gaylord or something?
Yeah.
Is it? Okay, yeah. So about in the middle of the state.
The thing about rallying this country, I really believe that for it to...
Look at this.
Look at that.
You know, we don't have the audio, because what I love about it is the sounds are just so high-tech precision.
How close is this to a production Fiesta?
Not.
Well, I don't think so, but I mean, you know.
Yeah, thank you for that one, Dave.
I'm here to please.
No, I mean... It's built from a production Fiesta, but obviously, you know, the body is, but then you got the fenders all flared out to a level.
Here we go with some of the audio.
Yeah, he's doing over 100 miles an hour on sheets of ice.
I know, it's unreal.
Right? And look at it, I think he's in sixth gear. Yeah.
That little... What is that? Is that the turbo?
Turbo, yeah.
Just that little chip, you know, it's like, it's so alien, it's scary, because you know how fast this guy is going.
And he's just pedal to the metal, pull out. Look at that. Just,
The thing about rallying in this country, we somehow have to figure out, because back a while ago, stadium truck racing
was big,
was huge, especially in the West Coast. And if they could combine something where you have a rallying that comes in and out of a stadium and then goes back out or whatever. But true rallying is in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's...
Except, I don't know if you remember, because I went down, it was either 1970 or 71, the World Rally Championship, with the Michigan Press On Regardless Rally was part of the World Championship.
Right.
They were on Belle Isle in downtown Detroit.
71, yeah.
70, 71, I wanted. Lancia came over with their two Stratos cars. Right. John Buffum was running Ford Escorts at the time. And on some of the bridges on Belle Isle, these guys were getting airborne. And I mean with lots of air going down the road. And it was a great venue, you know, downtown Detroit on an island, albeit.
Yeah.
But so you can bring it if you...
It's got to be a way to combine the...
Where you can bring the people, you know, don't make the people go to the rally. In this country, it's not going to happen. You got to bring their, you know...
You got to figure out a way to combine Supercross, which is awesome to see, with rallying. And as soon as someone does that, I think it'd be...
You know, the closest thing is the X game. Where they have the rally.
Right.
And then you actually have the jumps inside the stadium, and it goes over the seats and goes into the parking lot.
Right. What about...
Which brands are competing against you in rally in the U.S.?
Subaru is the kind of the preeminent
player.
Then some Mitsubishi. So Subaru, Mitsubishi, and...
Mini doesn't do it here? I mean, don't they rally in Europe?
No, I'm not aware. And I think... But I've seen them... They're trying to come back in or enter a Mini in...
But that, you know, the presence of Ford and maybe some other more mainstream brand. I mean, Subaru's doing some great stuff these days. They're growing big. But, you know, right now it's niche car brands and it's a niche race. I mean, if, you know, maybe if some bigger brands you know, with bigger support got into it.
They need to change the defining elements of the...
Well, the Race of Champions is almost along the way of what you're talking about. You know, they race indoors, and it, you know, it's a dual track, but that's all you get is two at a time, and it's not, you know, the great part of World Rally Championship is you're out and you're running in different countries and out on the open road. That's what makes it so terrific.
But I, you know, I'm encouraged what I'm hearing from NASCAR, and I've been NASCAR's biggest critic
by far. Big time.
Over the last decade. But I'm encouraged that they understand that business as usual isn't as business as usual anymore. So I fully expect we're going to see things like direct fuel injection. We're going to see stock dimension bodywork. We're going to see, I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see Camaros and Mustangs rolled into the Sprint Cup eventually. So,
well, I hope it's not done with details.
Challengers. No. Yeah. No, we're talking stock dimension. We're going to go back to the old days in NASCAR when all the manufacturers lobbied in tech inspection. Well, I need an eighth of inch more on the front air dam. And the other guy says, well, if they're going to get that, then I need a quarter inch on the rear spoiler. And, you know, that's fine because they'll bring back the hardcore fan, which they've turned off a lot by a lot of NASCAR's move. They've abandoned classic tracks, classic dates. By going to Car Tomorrow, everything, you know, they're all identical. People aren't stupid. And it might be trite, but there are still Ford people out there and Chevy people and Dodge people. And NASCAR just cut all those people off at the knees when they went to the Car Tomorrow. So that's why I'm encouraged what I'm hearing from down in Daytona.
And the first step was the nationwide where NASCAR really brought back and allowed some more latitude in the design. And the front and the rear clip, nonetheless, is still it's an evolution. It's not the stock dimension yet, whereby, you know, a Challenger and a Mustang have cues of Mustang and Challenger. And then, you know, they progress beyond that. But when we announced that Mustang is going to run it nationwide, I mean, the bulletin boards, the forums, the emails were all lit up because, you know, people like to see that car in its truest form. And it's a step. But ultimately, you got to get
there. I'll buy it if it's a step because, you know, when I heard the Mustang was going to be in, my expectations were pegged and I saw the car and I was like, it's just more decals.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's decal with more character line. I think we got to get past, you know, we got to move on to...
I'm for what Peter said, stock dimension.
Yep, that's...
Do you think we will at some point get to cars that are, you know, a lot more even technologically similar to the cars on the road?
We're not that far off because NASCAR also owns Can-Am. And in Can-Am, there is a series called the Rolex DP/GT. DP is a Daytona Prototypes, and that's obviously that. But in the GT class, you have stock dimensions, in this case, Camaros. There's a Challenger. And somebody ran a Mustang last year. See, there's stock dimensions, BMWs, Porsches, and competing at the highest level of road racing. Yeah. So, and that series is owned by NASCAR. So we're there's and they sometimes they present them during NASCAR weekends.
Yeah. So look for a transition, especially NASCAR runs two road races right now. Look for a transition away from the Car Tomorrow on the road courses to the Can-Am GT spec cars. I really believe we're going to see that, and sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. And that will, we were talking about the glory days of the Trans Am, that's going to be a lot like that, because all of a sudden you're going to have the best driver, or some of the best drivers in this country in cars you can recognize, beating on each other, going around a road course. And, you know, that's going to bring a lot of fans back.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's, you know, people have always said, win on Sunday, sell on Monday. Now, the auto executives I know who like racing say, oh, it's absolutely the case. And the ones who don't care about it say, that's a bunch of BS. Now, I'm asking the racing guy, of course, but you said you guys do a lot of research here. So is there any proof that there's a link between, you know, what you do at the track on Sunday and you know, selling, not just on Monday, but, you know, any time after that? I mean, does it really help you? Because, I mean, what occurs to me here is that the people who are out there rooting for Ford on the track, they're already Ford fans. They drove there in an F-150.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, Ford wins that day and, you know, the guy who drove there in his Camaro or his Silverado is like, yeah, I'm going to buy me a Ford.
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't see that happening.
Well, very good point. I mean, we constantly have to address that because budgets are tight, and the marketing budget is where the racing budget comes from. Last year, we came up with that because we know the research shows that the fans really follow the drivers, right? The drivers are the personality of the stars. So for us to just kind of say, oh, the car is running on the track is a Ford Fusion, people are going to buy a Ford Fusion, it's not going to work. So we reached out to the drivers that the fans follow and asked the drivers to drive the new Ford, drive the Taurus, drive the Fusion, and then we're going to get them in Fiestas, drive the Mustang, and then go out to their fans and say, I drove the Taurus. Here's all the technology on the Taurus. I was impressed with it. And go on YouTube, put all that stuff. That works.
So that basically works. Using the race as a venue just to market your
exactly.
Car.
Exactly.
In fact, here we got on the screen
there you go.
Carl Edwards doing sort of a walk-around road test of the Taurus.
Like the program's called I Am Driving One, and all of our drivers drove a Taurus and then blogged about it.
In the old days, there was win on Sunday, sell on Monday. It really hasn't been that in a long time. Racing for the manufacturers has turned into an image platform for what they want to project out to the public. Because you hit upon it, David, for the most part, the people going to NASCAR races are already in. They've already bought in. But there's a whole bunch of image reinforcement going on on the weekends of the races, outside of the actual speedway, that is important. But the old win on Sunday, sell on Monday thing, it doesn't apply anymore, really.
What Chevrolet actually used to tell me was that if they tracked not races, but championships, and tracked championships over years, and related that to Chevrolet market share in predominantly the southern states, they said they could see a correlation.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm just telling you what they told me.
Yeah, you know, there's what happens on the track, and championships are important, and winning is important because, like I said, racing is a marketing program, but it's also rooted in competition. And when there's competition, you have to win. Otherwise, it's not effective marketing. So the first thing is you got to win. But then you have to we use the word activate. You have to present your products. You got to present your message. Well, that requires incremental spending to go out, set up displays, and come up with communications brochures, and that's
so
where.
Does that come out of your racing budget, or is that the marketing guys? Because they're basically just, what you're setting up there could be set up at a Baltimore Orioles game. I mean,
that's another very good point. But we are a car company, right? And then ultimately, when you're a car company and there's a race going on, and your brand has the opportunity to showcase its potential. That's why we see a lot of value out of being at a race to activate, because obviously you're connecting with what's going on in the race. But ultimately, the real effectiveness of NASCAR is that it's broad appeal, and it's, in this case, very mass appeal. And also the fact that our drivers are really genuine, and they articulate from genuine perspective. They're not just paid to pitch. They really genuinely care for and talk about Ford. And that is credible, and that resonates with the fans. But it's a great marketing program. It works, and we got to progress it.
Hey, this is probably a good place to take a quick break. We got to talk about our sponsor, Dow, and then we got to get back to this tipping point issue, Peter, that we raised earlier. But we want to thank our sponsor, Dow. They've been great. This is probably the last show that they're going to be with us, at least for now. Maybe they'll be back. Love to have you check them out at DowBetaMate.com. And, Jamie, a couple of the things they work on is structural adhesives and structural foam, which they say that you can use for lightweighting a car. Because if instead of pinch welding a car, if you can have structural adhesives with a constant bond across a seam, then you can lessen the gauge of the material because you got a better bond. I'm just wondering, any applications in racing, or does Ford use any of that?
Yeah, I'm sure. I'd like to learn a little bit more about it, but it sounds as if it could have potential application, given the fact that emphasis on weight reduction. And absolutely it can.
Cool. Well, again, thanks, DowBetaMate.com, and you can check out all the information at their website at DowBetaMate.com.
I wonder if it could be applied to some of the safety systems in race cars.
Well, you know, Dow makes that impacts foam that's in the sides of the car of tomorrow, and they literally bounce off the walls in many cases. And
yeah, it's amazing to see that.
You know, I actually think, if I'm not mistaken, I think Corvette Racing pioneered that side impact thing, and that's
uses
race cars.
And I say bounce off the wall. It's not meant to do that. It's meant to, you know, absorb impact for the driver. But yeah, I would think it could. But I want to get back to this tipping point issue that you raised in on your website this week, because I find it fascinating. I am just, I mean, what a difference a year has made. If you had told me in February of 2009, oh, John, you know, in a year from now, everyone's going to be singing Ford's praises and how GM's getting back on its feet and how Toyota is just losing it all and their quality's in the toilet, I would have said, nah, never. And now, what I'm also even more amazed on is the media is really starting to pile on. I mean, I'm talking about the mass electronic media is really running with this story. So my question is, are we at a tipping point where, not just for Toyota, but could this mean a resurgence for the Detroit 3? Because I'm just amazed at how the media is going after Toyota on this.
Well, you know, let's face it. For the past three decades, for the most part, Toyota has built up this invincible aura. Quality, reliability, durability. They never break down. And, you know, legions of Americans, because there was a time, about a 20-year period, where Detroit disappointed big time. And legions of American consumers just walked away. They walked to imports, the German manufacturers, but they primarily walked away to Toyota and Honda. And that's all we've known, really. And, you know, so Toyota was almost on a pedestal. There was Toyota and everybody else. Even Honda, you know, had to fall in behind. But in 10 days' time, in this media-saturated environment we live in, which is 24 hours a day, social media, Twitter, everything all at once, all of a sudden, it used to be, you know, it's kind of like the old days of Volvo. When you heard Volvo, everyone said safety. Mm-hmm. Well, everyone's in that game now, so Volvo kind of lost its mojo there. And in the old days, and right up till now, when you heard Toyota, most consumers would say quality. I mean, they were bland transportation devices for the most part. Even when they did the Lexus, it was a luxury wrapper and a bland transportation device. But, you know, for a large amount of consumers, that's fine. They're not all enthusiast consumers like we are. But that has all changed. I really believe there's a fundamental shift, because now Toyota isn't on a pedestal. They have become what they never wanted to be. Just another car company with all, you know, just clawing for what they can get, because all of a sudden this automatic moniker of quality is not attached to that car company anymore. And I think it's a fundamental shift in this market. You have too much competition. You have Ford on the upswing. You have Hyundai on the upswing. As David's mentioned, you know, if Volkswagen ever fulfills the promises they're making, they're going to be on the upswing. GM's got some great products. If Sergio's thing works, it's just a different ballgame now. Toyota used to be separate and almost detached. You know, it was just like this juggernaut, this machine that was going to just swallow up everything. And now it's all over. And people are telling me, you're overreacting. This is going to blow over quick. I do not believe that for a second.
Not this week, I don't. You know, a week ago, if it had ended, I would have said that. But, Dave, do you think same thing, tipping point, or no?
Yeah, I do. And now, the question is, to what degree? I think, at a minimum, Toyota is going to be viewed as just any other car company. I mean, and what I mean by degree is, you know, could it be people start really running away from the brand? I don't think that's going to happen. Some people will. But, you know, their ability to gain market share and just grab buyers with every new model and every new plant they put up, that I think is gone. And because now they're just any other car company, they've got their problems too. And people are going to view the brand and their products on kind of a more even competitive field. What I think you'll see is the baby boomers who've been driving Toyotas for 15, 20 years, they're going to say, well, you know, they're going through a bad patch. I'm going to stick with them because I've had good Toyotas for 20 years. It's Gen X and Gen Y who've maybe had one or two good Toyotas, and frankly, Gen Y isn't all that hot on Toyota. Scion's been a flop in terms of getting younger buyers. Toyota's average age has gone up. So the younger buyers, they're not going to be able to just grab them easily anymore. They're really going to have to fight it out. And that's not really what they're good at because, you know, young people do tend to like cars. You know, it's more of an expression of their personality, or they like design, or they like performance more. It's not just a tool to take the kids around. So they're going to look at other brands, and that's where Toyota's, at a minimum, their big, easy market share gains are gone. They could lose out from this. I think Ford will be the one who can really make gains off of this, because Ford has been, for a couple of years now, positioning itself as the American Toyota. You guys are pushing quality. Mm-hmm. You're pushing hybrids and technology. GM can gain from this, but it's going to be tougher because, you know, what are GM's strengths right now? We've talked about this in past episodes of the show.
Well, they have product, but they don't have marketing.
I wonder if it's changing.
They have performance, and they've got really good design. They have quality, but people don't really know it, and they get no credit for the gains they've made. It's not part of their brand right now, and I don't have a lot of faith in their marketing to really get that word out very well. So, you know, if for people who buy Toyotas, they're not people who are big in design, otherwise they wouldn't buy a Camry. They're not into performance either. I mean, some of them may be, but that's not their DNA. Those people will look to Ford, they'll look to Hyundai or Honda first. GM can gain from this, but it's going to be tougher because, you know, what GM's been pushing is excitement, design. I mean, yeah, I'm blown away by the Camaro. Sorry, but it's outselling Mustang. You know,
yeah.
But that's more when I think of the new GM, I think of the CTS, I think of the XTS that's coming, I think of the Camaro. I think of really good designs like the Equinox, which I think is one of the best SUVs out there. Yeah, SRX. I mean, I think of design and performance and excitement, and that's not so much what these people who may leave Toyota are going to look for.
Yeah, maybe not. But, you know, one thing that I found very interesting in the January sales figures, which
Malibu,
Well, yeah. Malibu easily outsold Fusion, blew it away.
Retail?
I don't know about retail.
There's a lot of fleet.
There was a lot of fleet action in January.
You know, everybody goes, oh, fleet. Listen, if I'm in the car business building cars, you betcha I want to sell it to fleet because I'm not doing it the stupid old way that I used to do of stripper models that I let them dictate to me what I had to do and sold them at a loss, destroyed my residual value when they came back to lease or came back to auction in 6 months. Them days is gone. Anybody who knows half of anything in this business knows that, especially commercial fleet, you can make good money on that. And even the daily rental thing is important. So I don't sneer at fleet like some people do. Like I said, if I'm in the business of building cars, I want to build cars.
Well, but the question's a good one. How did they do it? I mean, I think the Malibu is a terrific car. It's actually, you know, one of my favorites.
Outsold
in that
Camry,
segment.
Not
I know, but
Fusion.
I've been covering GM for 10 years. I know the company's a bit different now, but I am just conditioned to think that when they have some great sales victory in a month, something's funny. There are incentives. There's fleet sales. Now, you know, we got to dig into the numbers. I'll give them a little bit of a
better. You got to dig, but I'll say two things here. They gained market share. They gained market share getting rid of four brands. They gained market share. Also,
I've been saying
Chevrolet up 58%. Ford was up 35%. I'm talking brands now, not Ford Motor Company. Ford brand versus Chevrolet brand. The Traverse is selling like rocket, you know, like hotcakes. The Equinox is red. I looked at those numbers and I went, oh, my God, is GM learning how to sell and market now? At least Chevrolet has done it. Buick's done it. Cadillac had a pretty lousy month.
Well, remember something about GM. Over the last really 4 months, maybe five, they've actually been advertising and marketing. They've been, you know, they've got the budget now outside of bankruptcy to spend some money. I mean, they weren't in the market at all last year. And people were wondering, why is Ford selling well in GM? Well, you know, GM had the acrid stench of bankruptcy and government assistance. Yep. But they weren't marketing either.
Yep.
Now they are. They're spending on incentives.
All I'm saying is, and you're right, don't look at 1 month and draw all these conclusions, but...
Plus Chevrolet up 58% from...
From a year ago.
From a year ago, which is like...
Right, which was devastation.
So what do you think, John? What do you think about this Toyota thing?
I think we're at a tipping point. I really do. I think that there could be a growing backlash in this country that I relate totally to the unemployment rate, that... If we say, the Japanese, they don't let us in their country, and, you know, they block us, well, what a big deal. And Korea, you know, we don't sell any cars there, whatever.
You think this is the long-awaited waving of the flag?
But at 10% unemployment with no turnaround in sight, and in this state, what is it now, 14%, a lot of other states hot on Michigan's heels with high unemployment, I sense a real... growing concern amongst people. And now, all of a sudden, you smash this aura of invincibility that Toyota's had in quality. Smash it good. And now have the media piling on in a frenzy like I would not have expected just a week ago. It's all raced forward in just 1 week's time.
Well, remember you said, and we agreed, I mean, fix it, move on, and you can't have one more recall, not even for a dome light.
Oh, and then we got Prius.
Or a cup holder. And then here's the holy grail.
We've had two recalls, Prius, and now Tacoma's been added to it.
Yeah, but just the fact that the Prius, it's just like, oh, boy.
Which is the halo of the halo.
Yeah.
The thing is, what Toyota is going to say is, you know, they're voluntarily doing this, which, frankly, they have to do even if they don't think...
Ray LaHood's not saying they're doing it voluntarily.
No, but, I mean, you know, the
recall
is going forward.
He put a gun to their head, practically.
And they have to do it voluntarily because they can't have it in the press that they were, you know, elbowed or cajoled or goaded into it. But consumer, I mean, after this, I don't care if they voluntarily do it. Consumers aren't going to be listening to that. They're going to be saying, geez, what's happening? I mean, the wheels are coming off the wagon with this company. They're not, you know, they can't build anything right anymore. You know, what's interesting with this, okay, here we are in 2010. The cars that were recalled were, for the most part, like 07 to 010 model years. So I think Avalon may have gone back to 05. But, and now you've got Prius, which is an 010 model. You're looking at cars that were engineered and developed around, what, 02, 03, 04 timeframe. This is when Toyota had their foot on the gas, plants springing up left and right, building pickup trucks, stuff with new platforms and SUVs that they weren't doing before. You know, and not just in the U.S., around the globe, they're in this massive expansion. And they were doing two things. They were stretching the resources of the managers and the engineers that they had who grew up in the Toyota way. And they were hiring new people in North America and all over the globe and trying to teach them the Toyota way while expanding all at the same time. And they sort of diluted that institutional knowledge of, you know, great manufacturing and Kaizen and Lean and everything else. And so here you have, like, you know, all of this work being done by a lot of new people and by a lot of older people who are being stretched. And that is when stuff falls through the cracks. I mean, it's a theory, okay?
No, it's not a theory. And I'll add one more thing to it, too.
Well, there's meat behind
the
theory.
They stopped following the Toyota way. And I'll give you a good example. When they first started to build the Camry in this country, what'd they do? They took a clone of the Tahara plant in Japan, and they built it in Kentucky. They bought exactly the same equipment that was in that plant in Japan, and they bought it in Japan, and they brought it to the United States. So, I mean, they drop it on the floor Six Sigma ready. They bring over the exact same processes, same bill of material, same bill of process. They do everything exactly the same. The only variable was the workforce. That was, and they took those people and they sent all the team leaders to Japan and had them do everything. So what did they do when they went to San Antonio to build the truck plant? All new truck, all new process, all new equipment, all new plant, all new workforce. I'm telling you, the old Toyota would have never done it that way, and they did that on multiple plants all around the world. They violated their own principles.
Yeah, no, you're right.
They always tried to maintain the most minimal amount of variability, and that's why they would just clone everything the same.
Well,
and
Toyota,
they violated their own principles.
They did, and I mean, what Toyota used to do is, whenever they were going to invest money or launch a new car, a new plant or whatever, or any new business initiative, they looked at the worst-case scenario, the best-case scenario, and the likely scenario. And they made the investment based on a pretty good likelihood of the worst-case scenario happening so that if it did, they would still make money on it. It would, you know, they wouldn't, you know, basically lose their ass on the thing. And it was that kind of conservatism that Honda still practices. Mm-hmm. They don't throw plants up if they aren't absolutely sure the demand is already there. And here you have a plant in San Antonio that's underutilized. They have a shell.
A million miles from nowhere, by the way.
Yeah. They have a shell in Mississippi that they haven't even installed tools and started building cars in yet. I mean, now give them a little bit of, credit because... Or mitigation, maybe, because, you know, he had this deep recession that people didn't foresee, credit crisis and all of that happened after they built these plants. But still, you know, this isn't the conservative Toyota that only built when they knew the customers were going to come. This was build it and they will come, and they're holding the bag. And, you know, that doesn't cause quality problems, but it shows you that they have abandoned some of the principles that made it.
They have, but I'll tell you one thing. We also saw earnings today from Toyota and Honda, both quite profitable. Toyota made, it was $1.8 billion or $1.9 billion of profit. Honda made $1.5 billion in profit. These guys jumped on their costs it was a snake in the grass. They got that under control very, very quickly.
But let's talk about the cost that this is going to have money-wise to Toyota. because it's going to be staggering.
UBS analyst in Tokyo said that it's 105. Well, he said $105 million a week that they've got all these cars grounded and plants shut down.
And somebody said, I don't know if it's the same guy, that they're going to lose 100,000 sales, 80,000 of which will be in North America. That's not insignificant.
Plus the cost of the recall itself. Well, bringing the cars in, getting
the total number I read on that was $2 billion. But this thing isn't over. I mean, that might have been an estimate that was made this morning and this afternoon and no longer applies.
Plus the marketing money they're going to have to spend to get back.
They're not going to do much. I mean, I've talked to a few people in the company, and they say, you know, don't expect some big push afterwards. And I've talked to a couple of crisis PR experts. I'm curious to get your views on this, you know, with your advertising background. What do you do? What can you do after something like this? What PR wizardry or marketing chops can you pull?
Out of this thing, I'll give you an example. When GM came out of bankruptcy initially, and they ran that spot
with Ed Whitaker.
No, before that, remember they ran a spot that was all pickup footage, and it was a disaster. They ran it too soon, and they got pilloried for it, and it was just a bad idea. Was before the Whitaker. Remember it was.
I do remember it now. And I think you were saying it looked like it was just all a bunch of B-roll footage that they edited together.
And I think they have to sort of go dark for a while and make sure everything is, boy, this company cannot afford another recall. I mean, we were saying
but they're going to happen.
Yeah,
Because everybody has.
But eventually they're going to have to get out of the duck and cover mode and say, boy, we're going to have to get back in the game.
Well, that brings up a good point. Where's Akio Toyoda? You know, his name, albeit spelled slightly differently, is on the building, as they say,
Well, they found him at the
at Davos.
Davos,
yeah.
But, right, yeah, they ambushed him there, and that's the only way they got
getting into an Audi.
Really?
Is that right?
It was a German car. I mean, they didn't have a Toyota there.
Unbelievable. Well, hey, time to get to rapid fire. Ben, bring up the graphic. Okay, here we go. We've got a question from our good buddy Pedro Fernando for you, Jamie. He says, besides getting Ford's name out there, is there any other benefit to sponsoring racing, like in technical advances for Ford?
Certainly. In Grand Am, where we were active in the Mustang in 2005, when the car was debuting there, the car has a very frontal nose, and the hood flew off after about 3 laps. And then that learning of all the air being packed in the front of the Mustang was directly responsible to putting vents in the GT500, which obviously is capable of higher speed than a Mustang GT. So there is always learnings in various forms of motorsports, and we take advantage of them, absolutely.
Good. Yeah, we here at Autoline After Hours fully subscribe to using racing as a way of developing production cars.
Yeah, especially if it makes the cars faster.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, right. Gives them street cred. Okay, more for Peter and David. Just wondering, in the light of Toyota's woes, what does that say for the J.D. Power's Quality Awards? Is someone asleep at the switch? That came in from Dave White in Royal Oak.
Well, look, there are two things that sort of run counter to all these recalls. I mean, Toyota keeps saying as well that their warranty costs are looking good, and by all their internal metrics, they're doing just great on quality. You know, one of the things with surveys from Power, or whether it's Consumer Reports or anybody, particularly with brands like Toyota, is, you know, the people love their cars, they love the brand, and I think they sort of give them benefit of the doubt. And it was sort of like when Buick used to always do really well in J.D. Power. You got older buyers who've been in generations of Buicks, and, you know, the thing was that they just aren't that discriminating because they don't have, and it's not that they're rubes or anything, they just don't have a frame of reference other than the Buicks they've been in for the past 20 years. And I think because Toyota does have loyal buyers, and their frame of reference is that car. And, you know, remember, J.D. Power doesn't measure defects, it measures complaints. I mean, that's basically what it does. And if the people aren't complaining, you know, they're going to do well. Peter?
I concur.
Good, because we got another issue here.
Yeah, I figure we want to move on.
Yeah. With so many recent automotive problems and recalls seemingly related to electronics, the Toyota acceleration, which is electronic throttle control perhaps, Cobalt's power steering, Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple, saying that he thinks there's software problems with the Prius cruise control. Ralph Norick wants to know, what's this say for the reliability and potential problems in an all-electric car?
Well, the dreaded ghost in the machine has surfaced. I mean, you know, there's electronic glitches, and Toyota's denying it. I believe there has to be something in the software somewhere. But what does it say for the electric cars? I mean, you know, this is going to be difficult technology. It's not going to be like, well, here's an electric car. It's going to run great. Everything's going to be fine. I mean, there's going to be a learning curve. And I have to believe that electronics and faulty electronics is going to rear its head.
Yeah, look, at least my column on electronic glitches has me banned from test driving Aston Martins. But, you know, when BMW and Mercedes started packing all these gadgets in the dashboard, there were all kinds of problems, and they did poorly in J.D. Power surveys and everything else. And, you know, back then it was just a customer service issue because if your stereo or your nav system has a glitch, you know, it annoys you, but nobody gets hurt. This is safety now, and it's a big deal. And that's, you know.
Well, I remember Mercedes was replacing the command center for $7,000.
Oh, God, the screen, their nav screen is like $7,000-$8,000. Don't break it, folks. It's horrifically expensive. Jamie, Dana Lewis from Brampton, Ontario, wants to know, with Chevy bowing out a sponsorship of racers in the NHRA, will Ford step up to fill the void?
We have a very active and very successful plan at NHRA. We won the championship last year in the funny car with John Force Racing. We just introduced the Cobra Jets in sportsman class, and then we're making a return to Pro Stock. So really, we are on a natural plan, we're not looking for the ad from other competitors.
He says, have you met John Force? Obviously you have. What's he like to work with?
I've met John Force, and John Force has me on his speed dial. And you haven't really met John Force until he calls you.
I've met him in person. He's a hoot.
He is a hoot.
Force of nature.
Yes. He wears his heart on his sleeve, everything that he thinks. He tells you. But, you know, he's a passionate advocate of, for Ford. And, man, he is NHRA, and we call him the Elvis of the sport. So it's right on.
He also wants to know, and I don't know if I'm saying this guy's right, Tony Pedregon accused Force of cheating. Whatever became of that?
That's right.
We'll leave that one between John
and Tony.
Tony.
I remember watching that live.
Here's Jay Cujo wants to know, why is it that when it comes to redesigning or freshening up current vehicles, the domestics always seem to build from the ground up, whereas the Asians have been taking existing platforms and improving them for what seems like forever? That's a really good point. I think we're seeing that change at Ford. The new Fusion refresh, car of the year, off to the races. I've just seen, I guess it's embargoed, but I can say I just saw the new Ford Edge, exact same approach, you know, mega freshening without really ripping up the hard points or any of the hard tooling in
and
the
it
car.
It looks great.
And it looks, and the interior is
spectacular. Yeah.
Fantastic. Let's see, what else do we have here? We probably should get some more questions out to me, too. This is a really, really good question. Do it 2X. From Southfield, Michigan, says, why is Denso getting a pass on this unintended acceleration issue? You know, we all know about CTS. I'm guessing from the question that Denso is the other supplier.
That's the other supplier on the part.
Okay, why are they getting a pass? He says, are we to believe that the Toyota design is not the same for the CTS and Denso? Excellent question. Toyota's disdain for complexity should answer that question, meaning they are the same. And are we also supposed to believe that Denso is not the supplier on any of their top-selling models?
I think some of the techs I've talked to at the dealerships have told me this, that they just haven't had the problems with cars that have the Denso parts.
Why?
And this was a theory kind of offered up to me, so you know we'll couch it with that. There's some kind of this guy called it nylon, but some sort of plastic film that prevents that moisture and corrosion that they were talking about. And Denso had a different or perhaps a better piece than CTS did. I mean, that this was thrown up there as a theory, but, you know, look, they've got to be using different materials for one to have corrosion and the other to not have it. I mean, you can have the same design, but if you're using, you know,
different materials.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, still, Toyota would dictate. I mean, they control they have their throat around their suppliers' necks when it comes to anything technical.
What did we talk about 15 minutes ago? Toyota has been straying from dictum for some time now, and that, you know, they figured this one must have figured whatever CTS, well, they obviously figured whatever CTS gave them is good enough. Even one of their PR guys said, look, we take responsibility because we spec the parts, we engineered the parts, they passed our approval, and we sold it in our car with our warranty on it. What else do you need to know?
Good enough hasn't been good enough for a long time. Toyota set that bar.
Right.
They lost their way. It's not the Toyota way. They've lost their way.
And Rob Mitchell wrote in, and I believe this is the Rob Mitchell I know from BMW or ex-BMW. I don't know if you guys know. And it says, ride hard, ride free. So that makes me really think that it's Rob Mitchell that I know, and he says, I haven't heard any mention of the cost to Toyota for this pedal recall. Any ideas? Well, I guess we did talk about that. We're thinking, would you say $105 million a week?
$155 million a week is what the analyst at UBS in Tokyo was
that saying. That starts to add up real money after a while.
Right.
$600 million a month?
Yeah.
Let's see. What else do I have here? Frank Tupka, he's sort of saying what we've been saying. They need to, this is back to racing again, Jamie. They need to go back to the 50s and 60s when cars were modified versions of street cars, which gets back to your point of, how'd you put it?
Production-based,
production spec. Well, great. And here's
stock dimension bodywork.
Okay, we got a phone call from Kenny in Virginia. Ben, let's bring Kenny in.
Product for product, how does Toyota compete with
Sorry. Oh, that was the wrong one. Okay, can you get Kenny?
This is Kenny Leffel from Yorktown, Virginia. I just wanted to wish Jamie Allison success in his new job and the Ford can win some races this year. I'm a lifelong Ford owner. I've owned 12 Fords in my lifetime so far. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, Kenny. I also got your emails. you're truly, a passionate follower and a loyal follower of Ford. We appreciate it. And you have my word and everybody's commitment that we're going to do everything we can to return to our winning ways in NASCAR. We're pretty excited about what's going on there with the addition of the Richard Petty team. We're going to have a great lineup, great drivers. And new engine on the horizon and a couple of cars and going to transition in for the rest of the season. So you'll be proud.
Got more questions for you here. Mud Monster wants to know, Ford dreaming of returning to Le Mans? I know that's outside of North America, your purview, but
yep.
You might have some thoughts on that.
Well, there is a team today by the name of Matek Motorsports who ran an FIA GT3 the last couple of years and won the championship in GT3, and they run Ford GTs who have applied for an application and have secured the move into GT1 class, FIA GT1, who, if they're successful in running a Ford GT, that private team could return to Le Mans.
I think it's, if I'm Bill Ford Jr., I think there's two things Ford has to do. They have to go back to Le Mans
and win.
They have to go back to Indy
and win it. I vote for you, sir.
I tell you, I'm reading, I'm sure you guys have read it, the book, Go Like Hell.
Yeah.
Which chronicles what happened in the late 60s when Henry Ford and Enzo Ferrari were talking about Ford buying Ferrari. And then that didn't come down. And so the dude said, if I can't buy him, I'm going to go beat him. And
there was another part to his statement. He said, I don't care how much it costs.
Actually, you're right.
See, I want you to go back to Omaha just so I have an excuse to go to the race.
Yeah, right, right.
Well, you can fit my racing knowledge in a shot glass, but I love going to Omaha. It's a good time.
But one of my favorite parts in the book, I guess, so we went in 64 and 65, and then obviously you don't just wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to go to Le Mans and win. Mm. So it took a couple of years. So for the 66 season, the Deuce walked in, called in the executives, called in the teams, and walked in and passed out a card. And on the card it said, you better win, HF2. So anyway, I took a page from that book because of, you know, obviously our last year in NASCAR. So now our motto is that we will win. So we got a little inspiration from Henry Ford.
That's great. George from Brooklyn wants to know, does Lincoln have an equivalent to the CTSV? No, sir, it does not, at least not yet.
No.
With our MKS, with the twin turbo EcoBoost, I mean, that's a lot to be said there, but that's not a CTSV. That's just, you know, I would.
Here we've got one from Jason Jodish, and it says it's a video. Is this a video question? Oh, okay. He says, as I understand, the Cobra jet is supercharged. How is the decision made for supercharging rather than normal aspiration? Was a turbo considered, or is it in the future?
A turbo was not considered.
Not for drag racing.
Not for drag racing. Because obviously it's about you don't have time for turbo lag.
No time for turbo lag. That's a good way to put it. Hey, Ben, we got another phone call here. Danny Youngblood.
Oh, no, there's the video.
Oh, yeah.
That's actually Brian himself in the back of Ford Racing.
That's excellent.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah, well, we had to run that clip.
Yep.
And let's see, we're going to bring that other one in?
Yep. Hey, John, back in the 60s, I was a young buck back then, and I watched the Trans Am series. I loved it. I followed it religiously. It was great. American Muscle, Trans Am series. Loved it. Bring it back on. Back then, I couldn't afford a new car. I had to buy junkers and hop them up. That's why I'm a gearhead now. Learned everything because of that. Now I got the bucks. Bring on the Trans Am cars. Camaro, Mustang, Challenger. I got enough money. I'll buy at least one, maybe two. Well, you got a great show. Keep it up. Later.
Well, stay tuned because I... Stay tuned because I think we're going to see a shift in NASCAR, especially initially in the road races first, where we'll get a little taste of that, or a big taste of it.
Well, we agree completely. And in fact, we were talking earlier, before the show got going, on that very thing. We're 100% behind that suggestion. Let's see, what else do we have here? All kinds of questions. Let's see. Here's a comment from JBC6. He says, why won't the government invest stimulus dollars to create large-scale cascada plants for ethanol, which means is cellulosic ethanol? That's all coming on stream this year as we speak. Cellulosic ethanol is coming on. There's been a lot of government stimulus before that. I don't know is that they need to put more into it now. Now's the time for ethanol to get up on its own two feet and either make it on its own or not. That's how I see it.
It seemed to have lost its momentum in the...
Well, that's another component to the transition in NASCAR. There will be some sort of alternative fuel in NASCAR.
I hope, because...
I think they...
Well, now the oil companies are getting interested in ethanol, and I think that's where we're going to see a change. Both Shell and Exxon both are starting to put money into it, and that's where we could see a change. In fact, I just saw a national television ad from Exxon talking about its involvement in algae getting into to biofuel. So I'm still quite bullish on biofuel. Let's see. And Ben, looks like we've got another phone call. Let's bring that one in.
Product for product, how does Toyota compete with General Motors, Chevrolet, Cadillac, GMC, and Buick? Product for product, quality for quality, I'm sorry, performance, there's no way. How do you guys feel that Toyota is even close to General Motors once this false facade image of perfect quality has been destroyed?
Good question.
Jonathan Brown in New Jersey.
Well, thank you, New Jersey.
I don't know that the image is destroyed yet for Toyota. I mean, it's been severely damaged. But, you know, GM's got some great products. They've also got some stuff that's still hanging around that's not so great. I mean, that's the problem with GM right now is their product line is very uneven. You know, obviously there's nothing that competes with Camaro. I think the Malibu is better than the Camry. But, you know, the current Aveo next to a Yaris, no contest. It's the Yaris. The Corolla is better than the current Cobalt. Cruze, when it comes out, we'll have to see. I thought the car was going to be bigger than it is. You know, GM's got it in trucks, but, you know, it's really an issue of brand and brand loyalty still.
I also think overall, in general, though, the gap that used to be this much between Toyota and everyone else in quality is not like that anymore. It's almost on par in a lot of areas. So.
It is. In fact, on AutoLine Detroit this weekend, we've got a quality expert on from a company called the RDA Group, which does a lot of work with Ford, by the way, and he said, absolutely, for almost 3 years running now, he said statistically they can absolutely prove that Ford is the equal of Toyota and Honda up and down the product line. So it's there. And, you know, perception always lags reality. So here it is, 3 years of Ford doing it, and people are finally starting to catch on that. Yeah, it's been real. They've done it. Look, we got a lot more questions, but we're past the top of the hour when we usually wrap up. So
well, we're going to go into our second hour.
There's no shortage, that's for sure. But Jamie Allison, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been very interesting, and especially not just the racing part, but the whole business thinking behind it. That was very illuminating for me. I wasn't aware of all that.
Well, it's a treat to come and to be here, so thank you for inviting me. I'll look forward to come back.
And thank you for our, our cars.
Yeah.
You know, about 10 years ago, Ford had a lunch with John Force and some journalists, and this is when you guys had the Lincoln LS, and there was some kind of system. Remember Ford had something that was similar to OnStar? It was called WinStar or whatever the heck it was.
Wincast,
that's what it was. Mm-hmm. And Force is, you know, the company gave him an LS to drive for a while, and he had accidentally, like, hit the emergency button on it. And he's, you know, the operator comes on, and, you know, I'm going to get the story wrong because it was 10 years ago. And, you know, it wasn't his car. And they're asking him to identify himself. He's like, well, I'm John Force.
Yeah.
And said, well, are you the owner of the car? He said, well, no, it belongs to Ford. And, you know, and she's trying to get him to identify himself. And the sort of thing. She said, well, you're going to have to identify yourself as the owner of the car. Who are you? He goes, John Force, 3-time funny car champion. And he's going through all his accomplishments and everything and getting absolutely nowhere. And then, you know, he had to get on his cell phone or whatever and call someone at Ford to call this thing because they were basically shutting the car down on him or something like that.
By the way, 14-time champion.
14?
No, 14-time, yes.
Wow.
So.
Well, David, great having you here, as always.
Pleasure.
Peter, great having you here. And thank all of you for having watched.
14-time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks again to Dow Automotive Systems for their support of AutoLine After Hours. Visit www.dowbetamate.com to learn more about how Betamate is reducing vehicle weight and enhancing durability. That's dowbetamate.com. Visit our website, AutoLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there, and much more at AutoLineDetroit.tv.